You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 285.
On today's show, we talk about a Bronze Age battlefield, a cemetery found in a basement, and a submerged tomb at the pyramids of Nuri.
Let's dig a little deeper into why I can't say Bronze Age. Stop making fun of me. Welcome to the show, everybody.
Hello.
We're doing news articles.
I know. I feel like it's been so long.
Yeah, it's a new thing we're doing.
In fact, the date on this first article is from the end of September because it's been that long since we've recorded a news episode.
Yes. Anyway.
Well, yeah. All that means is that we probably will have a couple weeks of news episodes because I don't know about you, but I've just been saving up the stories as I come across interesting things. So,
indeed.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, this first article is titled, "Look at the Bones." We're starting with the Monty Python quote.
I literally don't remember what that's from, but okay.
I think we literally just saw that clip, or maybe I did because I had it playing in the background.
Yeah.
It's from Holy Grail.
That sounds right.
Yeah. Thousands of bones and hundreds of weapons reveal grisly insights into a 3,250-year-old battle. Yes.
Yeah.
This is from the Tollens Valley in northeastern Germany. Mm-hmm. The site was found in 1996 by an amateur archaeologist, aka somebody just roaming around and finding stuff, called themselves an amateur archaeologist.
I know. Like, are they just like a walker? Like if somebody out for a walk?
And if I put a Band-Aid on somebody, am I an amateur doctor?
Ooh, maybe.
Right?
Sure.
I'm a little irritated.
Well, maybe like an amateur
nurse.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I went to CVS and I tooled around the first aid aisle and I got some stuff and I opened a kit and then I, you know, cleaned up a wound.
Amateur paramedic.
Am I an amateur paramedic?
Amateur paramedic.
Nobody
sure.
calls them that.
Right.
Why? Because you dig around outside or you have a metal detector. Are you an amateur archaeologist?
It's like one of those things that news stories will never not
My
do.
God.
They just can't help themselves. Yeah. I don't know why.
You read a history book, you saw ancient aliens and now you're an amateur archaeologist.
Amateur historian right here.
Wow. All right. Well, I'm an amateur senior citizen, so...
That doesn't even make any sense. Are you amateur podcaster? Get on with this.
Oh, I'm definitely not that. All right. Anyway, they saw bones sticking out of the bank of the Tollens River. See? Mm-hmm. Just saw bones. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Excavations have since found 300 metal objects and 12,500 bones, that's a lot, mm-hmm. that belonged to 150 people that fell in battle around 1250 BCE.
Yeah.
All right. Now, why don't you tell us how 12,500 bones equals only 150 people?
Yeah. So I love talking about this because it was something I studied in college, but what they would have done to figure out how many people is identify a bone, a particular bone, and that became their like ID bone, right? And they counted how many of those bones they had across the entire collection. Mm-hmm. And they would have strategically picked that bone probably. Like if they had like a lot of skulls, then maybe they would have picked a skull bone. Or if they had, you know, like you're not going to pick a long bone where you might not have, you know, all of those pieces because they degrade away or whatever. You're going to pick something that is strategically well preserved and present in your
collection.
In your collection.
Yeah.
So whatever they picked here, they counted up 150 of them. And so that's how they went from 12,500 bones or probably fragments of bones being realistic to just 150 people.
Yes, indeed. Called minimum number of individuals.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what that's called.
Yeah. In technical terms.
Mm-hmm. There could have been more. That's why they say minimum. There could have been more, but minimum.
Weapons found included swords, wooden clubs, arrowheads, or they call them. Mm-hmm. They might not be from actual arrows, but arrowheads.
Mm-hmm.
That's just what people call them. Some found still embedded in bones, and there's a really cool picture.
Oh, the picture is so cool.
Yeah, the article from the inside of a skull.
Yeah.
Of literally an implement coming through the skull.
Isn't that just like...
Yeah, it looks like a metal implement, actually.
It's metal, yeah. I think it says metal. It doesn't it like just like hit you in your heart when you see that? Because you're like, that right there is like the moment of that person's death. Like, we are seeing that in the archaeological record.
They may not have died from that.
Are you kidding me? That arrow was straight into like 2 inches of brain.
Yeah.
Like you're not surviving that.
I'm sure it didn't feel good. I got a headache just looking at that.
I know. Yeah. It's just so, it just like hurts to know that that is how that is that person's last moment on this in this world.
Yeah. There has been no direct evidence of this scale of battle ever found earlier than this.
Yeah.
Because this was huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why they consider this Europe's oldest battle that we know of to date. I always feel like you have to quantify those kind of statements with that.
Yeah.
You never know what you're going to find in the future. But up to now, this is the oldest one.
Yeah. That should just be like implied.
Yeah. It really should.
Yeah.
But I don't know that news stories always imply it super well. They don't. But that's okay. We're here to do that for them.
Indeed. Now, so the bones revealed they were mostly men that were young and strong, many with healed wounds from previous skirmishes.
Mm-hmm. So this is like a fighting force that was trained and they were...
Or people just fought a lot back then.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I think what they're getting at here is these were people that were trained.
Yeah. No one knows who the people were that fought in the battle, however. With all the stuff that was found, apparently none of it is identifiable enough yet through analysis that they can tell, this was the blah, blah, blah army, or this was the, these people, which is interesting because a lot of times you can look at stuff and say, the style here, the markings here indicate these people, but they haven't really found that. There's no written accounts, no artifacts have revealed anything. There's just nothing so far that they've found that really leads to any clues in that way.
Well, it's like...
Yet.
They don't lead to specific people or specific groups. They've got the broad regions based on like the arrowhead types and stuff that they found.
Well,
but
that's the new part of the story though.
Yeah.
Is the arrowheads.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because
exactly.
Up until now, other analysis hasn't revealed that part of the story. Right?
Right.
But now that they're looking at the arrowheads and projectile points, they're finding that the battle may have included local groups as well as an army from the south, right? And that this may be one of the earliest examples of interregional conflict in Europe, right?
Isn't that interesting that it took this long to analyze the differences in shape and style of the arrowheads? Like, wouldn't you think that would be one of the first things they would do?
I don't know. It sounds like it's just the amount of stuff that they pulled out of here. You know, people go methodically.
Yeah.
They have a certain amount of funding and time. And it's just,
I suppose,
box by box.
Yeah, and I suppose you might focus on like the bones first because you just think you're going to get the most information from the people that are buried there. And the weapons sort of come after that, maybe. But
well, and a lot of times, as we know, when a collection like this is excavated, I mean, you're kind of looking at stuff as you're pulling it out. But the first job is to basically catalog it all and put it all into something, into a database to be honest, clean it up and put it into boxes.
Yeah.
And then what?
Yeah.
What people come along, they end up getting PhDs and dissertations out of this material. Mm-hmm. And somebody says, well, I want to study this and I want to study this and I want to study this. I mean, it's a lot of money and time to go through these collections.
Yeah.
For sure. So it just takes years.
There have been previous discoveries of foreign artifacts like a Bohemian bronze axe and a sword from southeastern Central Europe, indicating that there was interactions with other groups, not from this area, of course.
Yeah, the arrowheads, though, were interesting because it seems that no two were identical.
Yeah.
Which is odd.
Yeah.
And they could tell that these were not made by the local population, right? So there's, groups of people all over the place. There's stylistic differences when you make these things because it's really hard to make two identical to begin with.
Right.
So that's not unique for these types of things. But when you look at the overall shape, the morphology, archaeologists call it, you can tell generally from that people in one area kind of make it the same way.
Yeah.
You know, you're never going to make two identical to each other, but they kind of make it the same way.
Yeah.
Then you look at these people that are 50 miles away or on the other side of a range or in another valley. Mm-hmm. They kind of make it the same way too, but slightly different. You know, this base looks a little bit different. This angle is a little bit different, something like that. And that's what they started looking at. Mm-hmm. And they started realizing that, hey, the local population made them slightly different than what we're finding here. And we're seeing that there are some correlations with some populations elsewhere.
Away, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. The lead author in the current paper in the journal Antiquity, Leif Einzelmann, said they collected literature and data from more than 4,700 Bronze Age arrowheads from Central Europe and mapped out where they came from to compare them with the Ptolemy's Valley arrowheads.
Another study I was surprised hadn't been already done before.
It's so surprising, right? But like you said, it's just so much work and it takes somebody with an interest to like do that work.
Yeah.
Now it's available in the world, so nobody has to do it going forward and they can use it. But somebody had to do it first, right?
Yeah, many match the style of arrowheads from other sites in the region, suggesting they were made locally and carried by men who called that region home. So,
yeah.
But others were very differently shaped and matched those from the southern region in what's now modern Bavaria and Moravia.
Yeah.
So Einzelmann thinks that it's unlikely they were imported or traded for, and more likely they were carried by the men who fought with them. There's a causeway that crosses the Tollens River, and it was constructed about 500 years before the battle, and that's thought to be the starting point of the conflict. Essentially, this causeway was an important trade route, and control of it would have been powerful.
Mm.
So they're making a lot of conjecture here, a little bit. There's no evidence of this, so researchers are still looking for other options as to what could have been the other cause of the battle.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what they're trying to kind of say here is that you've got this huge fighting force, you've got evidence that people from another region, several other regions came by from the south, came up and helped fight or were part of the fight, didn't help, but they were part of the fight. So it's like, okay, are a whole bunch of different areas fighting for maybe control of this crossing? Because this is basically where it took place.
Yeah.
Is that the assumption that's being made here? I don't know. Maybe that's what they're saying.
Yeah, I guess the one thing that I kind of like trip over is how do we know for sure that the arrowheads involved weren't traded for? Like if there's a conflict brewing between two local populations in this area that already lived there, how do we know that they didn't start trading and stocking up on arrowheads in anticipation of this conflict? Like why are they so sure that it was groups of like fighting men that came in from other places?
I mean, I think my guess would be that if you've got a population of people that are fighting, I mean, they probably had their own weapons. Why would they have just traded for weapons on them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why wouldn't they have their own weapons and their own things in addition to maybe things they traded for? Yeah, there's probably a mix of things, but why wouldn't they also just have their own stuff? You know, they bring their own things.
Yeah.
You know, trade is obviously a deal, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. I feel like they would have shown up with their own stuff too. You know?
Yeah.
You know, this wasn't a village.
Right.
We can tell that.
Right.
There's no evidence that there was a village here.
Okay.
So this was a battleground. Mm. So you show up with weapons ready to fight.
I think it's really hard to draw conclusions.
It is an assumption.
Yeah. It's like a battleground in general. It just seems like a really, really difficult place to draw conclusions because you don't have any of the like habitation evidence that goes along with most sites. You don't have how people are living. You don't have any of that other context that helps fill in the blanks. So you're just kind of left drawing these assumptions. I don't really think that they're wrong necessarily. I'm just trying to understand how they got to where they got.
Yeah. The remains of the weaponry found suggest more than 2,000 people were involved.
Yeah.
Which again, that is a little bit, suspect too. It's like the bone analysis, you know, over 12,000 bones found and that represents 150 people, but then they say that there were over 2,000 people involved judging by the weapons. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know a lot of people probably got away and then maybe the MNI is wrong as far as the people go. So, cause they got differing numbers here, but anyway, they say this shows the Bronze Age. I like these quotes here or these comments. The Bronze Age wasn't as peaceful as was believed. I'm not sure anybody thought the Bronze Age was super peaceful, but the Bronze Age wasn't as peaceful as believed. And I'm going to jump down to one of our last notes here because there's also another comment that says Bronze Age societies also built fortified settlements and smiths to forge weapons, and that these weren't just displays of power, it turns out. Who ever thought those were just displays of power not actually used?
Right.
The article actually just wrote that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that seems weird to say that.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I don't know why anybody thought the Bronze Age was peaceful, but
yeah.
I mean, this is a giant battle. Obviously, it wasn't super peaceful. So, yeah. And as far as the 2,000 people involved thing, actually, that does kind of make sense to me because if you have the remains from 150 individuals, I mean, even in the worst battles, most of the people don't die. It's not 100% casualty rate. So if 150 out of 2,000 or so people were the casualties, I think that kind of does make sense from a proportion sense, you know?
Yeah, but so we're saying like 1,800 people just left their weapons there? Are they broken weapons?
Well, I think it's broken. Yeah, broken because arrows, right?
Yeah, but one person could have a quiver of 20 arrows.
Yeah, but one person's not going to be able to kill 20 people, though.
I don't know. Suspect. I don't trust their numbers. Yeah. Anyway, injuries do suggest that archery was involved, obviously, unless they were stabbing people with arrows.
Yeah, there's a really cool graph that shows all the different types of wounds that they found on the bodies, and arrow shots were very high up on that list. And you can see a lot of them all over the body. That was cool.
Which also suggests that shields were used, which apparently is a big deal.
Yeah.
Because this also suggests another one thing that suggests a large scale of battle. Because apparently all those factors suggest a large scale battle.
Yeah.
Right. They do. You don't use arrows in a small battle, apparently. Mm-hmm. You know, you use arrows when you have a field of archers shooting across a field.
Right. Because you got to be really good to hit a person. So if you have a whole pile of people in front of you, then I guess the chances are better of hitting one. Gosh, that's so dark when you think about it. Really, like, crazy. Crazy that they had to resort to war instead of just, you know, working it out. But, you know, that's humans for you.
All right. Well, let's take a break from that. And on the other side, we'll talk about a place in France where apparently it couldn't work out, a bunch of humans, and they buried them under a basement in France. Back in a minute. Welcome back to episode 285 of The Archaeology Show. And we are now talking about France and skeletons and renos.
More skeletons.
Yeah.
Skeletons have been in the news lately.
Just, apparently.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's The Archaeology Show.
Yeah.
There's a lot of skeletons in these closets. Right.
I have to admit to like my bias for skeletons too. I love them.
Yeah. I kind of also just like really want to buy an old house in Europe somewhere. But then also I kind of really don't because I have a desires to do that because I want to do a renovation and find something really old and cool, either in the walls or in the basement. But also, I don't want to live over a cemetery.
Oh, I totally want to live over a cemetery.
Yes, I kind of do as well. But also, I have like U.S. laws and regulations in place in my head because I'm afraid that, you know, if you bought a house in the United States, like an old house, and you found, I don't know, a cemetery of pretty much any kind in your basement, I'm pretty sure that would be bad for your property.
I think it would be. Yeah.
Yeah, really bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, this article, Accidental Basement Find, reveals dozens of centuries-old skeletons.
I mean, I think like in a place like France that has been occupied for so long by so many people throughout so much time that they kind of just have to like deal with it when skeletons are found in basements.
Indeed.
Yeah. Which is what they did here. So the preventative archaeology firm, which I don't understand that name.
I think it's a translation issue.
Yeah, I think so. Because you're not preventing
anything? What they called it. They called it preventative archaeology. Yeah. And I was like, that's an interesting term. It's got to be like CRM or something like that, but in France.
It must be. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, the firm is called Archeo Dunham. They excavated a site over the winter of 2023 and 2024 in the basement of a home in France, like we said. And the homeowner was doing a renovation and they accidentally found a skeleton. And then here we go.
I know. Could you imagine? They're like, ah, Christ, a skeleton. I wonder if this is like an old murder or something like that.
Well, you don't know. You have to call in experts because like it could be from somebody who died 20 years ago or in the case of this one, like 2000 years ago.
So I feel like they're cutting a bunch out here because what was that article in? I can't remember where it was, but that one where the like Roman table or something was being used as a bar.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was like, archaeology team, unite. Yeah. You know, like they called in the archaeologists. Right. Because now they say this jumps straight from, and this is a suburb in southern Paris.
Yeah.
They jump straight to a whole bunch of graves were found, but that wasn't the order of operations.
No,
the guy finds a skeleton and I'm sure called the police.
Probably.
And the police come in and we're like, yeah, dude, this is like 1,000 years old.
Like super old.
Yeah. And so they call probably whoever, a university, they call somebody and they're like, we don't do this. Call these guys. And they come in and then, you know, 3 months later.
And like who? Okay, this is like such a tangent, but like who has to pay for that? Is like the person building the house, do they have to like pay for the archaeology firm to come in and like excavate all of that?
No,
so they can go ahead with their renovation?
Again, not the United States. I'm willing to bet the government of France paid for it.
Yeah, because maybe.
It's under the ground. They probably own it.
Yeah.
It's history.
Yeah, true.
But anyway, a total of like this. I don't know how long these people have been living in this house.
Right.
But 38 graves, not one, 38 graves spread out across four rooms of this cellar.
Okay. Well, a cellar with four rooms means that this is probably a pretty large house.
Pretty large
right?
house. So, yeah. Well, every house in France is a mansion.
No,
so.
It's not.
Yeah.
So they were arranged in parallel rows and seemed to be part of a cemetery that was in use from the 3rd century to the 10th century.
Yeah. 700 years is a long time.
That is a very long time. Yeah. And apparently everybody kind of knew that there was a cemetery here in this area. So like the fact that they're finding graves, I guess, is not like a huge surprise. It's more about what the graves told them that is surprising.
Yeah. Since the 1800s, several plaster sarcophagi had been discovered in that area.
Yeah.
And scholars in the 19th century thought those burials were linked to the Notre Dame de Champs Chapel built in the 7th century on the site of a pagan temple in that area.
Yeah.
So they were like, oh, yeah, it must be part of this.
Yeah. I mean, why not? Right. I mean, it would make sense.
There's been no trace of these constructions found to date, however, and those graves were never fully really studied by modern science. That was, you know, several hundred years ago.
Yeah.
This new evidence suggests the cemetery is older than those scholars assumed anyway, and long before the construction of the chapel.
Yeah, and they have some reasons for thinking that now. So during the late Roman Empire, the deceased in the region were often buried laying down on their backs in a wooden casing in a very deep grave.
Yeah.
Not too different from like, you know, how we do it today, really.
Yeah, pretty much.
But the change though, it did change. And that's in the early medieval period, starting around 500 CE, the practice evolved to being buried instead in a plaster sarcophagi.
Yeah.
So you kind of can see that break in time through the burial practices.
Yeah. And this excavation uncovered 10 sarcophagi arranged side by side in a fan shape, which would just be crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, seeing that evolve excavate out under your house.
So crazy. Like what were they fanned out in front of? They must have been fanned in front of something. That's
some
why
kind of
you do a fan
probably
shape
or something.
Yeah. Maybe like a family,
right?
A family, whatever you call those big things.
Statue.
Mausoleum thing.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. Each had remains
family
in it.
Marker. Yeah.
Yeah. One of those probably had a map with a shield on its surface. I'm sure of it. That led to a treasure. Why didn't they know this?
Why are you always hunting for treasure?
I'm serious. Well, I mean, there had to be something.
Yeah.
I mean, the time period, I'm sure it led to the Crusades and some map in the United States. Come on. Seriously. Anyway, the boring part is all the remains will be analyzed in a lab to determine sex, age of death, and possible living conditions.
Yeah, they got to do more. But what? Okay, so again, these confusing news stories sometimes. They said that in the 19th century, they thought that the other burials found in the area were related to the chapel that was built in the 7th century, right? Which would be the 600s, right?
Yeah.
Well, this article is saying that these burials in this basement, the recent ones, are all buried in plaster sarcophagi that start using around 500 CE. That's only 100 years difference.
Yeah.
So why are they saying, oh no, it's much earlier. It's like, no, that's at the earliest, it's 100 years earlier. Or it's like the same time period, actually. So either I'm missing something in this article and it wasn't communicated well, or it kind of sounds like this really jives with what the earlier archaeologist said as well. And it's just adding more evidence to the same thing that we already knew.
I guess. Yeah.
I mean, am I misunderstanding that?
I mean, no, I guess. So, yeah.
I don't know. Maybe there are some of the older style graves mixed in with it. And so we have a transition cemetery. Who knows?
I want to know if the guy's done with this. Did he make some like Roman baths down there out of all this? Like, did they, you know, what's going on down there? What did his reno turn into?
Man cave.
Man cave. My God. Yeah.
Like, I don't think anybody does man caves anymore. It's not a thing.
Especially not in the suburbs of Paris.
Yeah. They're cooler than that.
Yeah. I mean, what does he do when, what was he going to do down there? Like bedrooms? Like what was he going to do? And is he like, all right, well, you know, you've got a bedroom down here. You've got your own bathroom. So we're going to leave you to sort out yourself. Oh, by the way, 38 people live down here. Kind of. They were buried. They were dead for 1,000 years. But don't worry about that. I'm sure they're gone now.
I think they need to set a season of ghosts here. Yeah.
Well, that show's not real. They never find anything. Oh, that show.
The show.
The fiction
the house.
Show.
Yeah.
I was thinking the...
Like a ghost hunter thing? No, yeah, no, 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 no. Yeah. Like the fictional show Ghosts, where they can see ghosts.
That would be great.
Wouldn't it be?
Yeah. but they'd all be like the people in the basement.
Yeah. The basement people.
The basement people that all died from what, that smallpox or something.
Yeah. Oh, ridiculous. Anyway. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, we're going to now end this and find out what happens when you go diving.
Oh, are you going to get your treasure hunt finally?
We're finally going to find some treasure. Yeah. Flooded tombs. Come on.
Yeah.
Back in a minute. Welcome back to The Archaeology Show, episode 285, and we are talking about flooded tombs. Go. It's quite the lead up.
Yeah, well, I did pick out this article, and I'm going to give two disclaimers about this article before we start.
Is the first one that it came from Idolator?
Yes, that is the first one. And
what the hell is that?
I don't know, but I found the tone of the article to be very like conversational, and there's like exclamation points and stuff. So like, you know, it was an enjoyable light read and I enjoyed that. And I cross-checked some of their like history facts that they were dropping in there. And generally speaking, most of it checked out. So like, I felt pretty good about it from a information standpoint, right? Yeah. However, what I was just doing right in the very second before we started podcasting was scrolling through and looking at the pictures just one more time, just to get it back in my head. And I'm like, wait a minute, all these photos say Getty Images on them.
Oh yeah. These aren't images from.
Yeah. And then I started looking closer and I'm like, we're going to get to this because this is about underwater archaeology. But they say specifically that they can't use any scuba tanks because the area is too tight. For scuba tanks, they have to use the long tubes that run the air down to you from the surface. All of these pictures have scuba tanks in them. So like every single image in this article is just pulled from random public place. And while I think the pyramids are correct, because that's what they do look like when you look them up, it's certainly not pictures that were given to them by the people involved in this article. And the scuba pictures are very misleading because none of those pictures represent the actual scuba diving that they did for this article. Mm-hmm. So there's your disclaimer. Take this with a grain of salt from a photo perspective. Otherwise, I kind of enjoyed the article. It was great.
Yeah. These articles, though, these kind of clickbaity websites, I don't know who sets them up and why, but they make money because of advertising, and these people just search for other articles on the internet and then they repurpose the same article. They maybe rewrite a few words to get around copyright and then drop in images and we click on them and read them.
Yeah. It does make me wonder if we should like research a little harder where this article came from, if we can find even an origin point for it, because
they might change just enough of the words to where you can't.
Yeah. But like I said, I enjoyed the tone of this article. It's not very journalistic. It has a point of view more so than, you know, the kind of boring, like toe the middle of the line journalistic articles do. So I appreciated that. It sounded like somebody with excitement about archaeology wrote this article, which is what I appreciate about it. So anyway, just keep an eye out for that kind of stuff when you're reading articles. This one definitely sucked me in because it was fun.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's talk about the fun part of it.
Indeed.
So underwater archaeologists Kristen Rami and Pierce Paul Kreisman went on an underwater exploration of a submerged ancient tomb in Sudan. And the article title is "Two Archaeologists Discover Something Extraordinary After Diving Into a Flooded Tomb." Spoiler alert, it was nothing extraordinary other than exactly what you would expect to find in a tomb. And that is extraordinary because it's a tomb, but it wasn't like special, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
So a body?
There's a sarcophagus in there and there's some other like potential things, but we'll get there. So this tomb is associated with one of the 20 remaining Nuri pyramids that were constructed by the Kushite royals. Hmm. And I had never heard of these pyramids and I had never really seen them either. They're like these taller, skinnier triangular pyramids. And they seem to have like a smaller footprint than the big ones that you think of from Giza, of course. But there's many more of them packed into a small space and they are pretty highly degraded. And there is evidence that like there are some medieval churches and stuff, or maybe mosques or whatever, that they repurpose stones from to build other buildings. So they've kind of been degraded by both human and erosion activity over the years. So they're not in super great shape.
Yeah. The Nuri served as the royal necropolis for the ancient city of Napata, which was the first capital of the Nubian kingdom of Kush. Yeah. The Kushite pharaohs ruled Egypt from 650 BCE to 300 BCE after the fall of the New Kingdom.
Mm-hmm. And during that time, they revived some of the religious practices of the older Egyptian kingdoms, like pyramids, like this. This is why we are finding pyramids here.
Mm-hmm.
And these pyramids, just like the ones in Giza, are located close to the Nile. But one kind of more interesting difference is the actual tombs where the kings were buried are underground. So because of that, they are all flooded or partially flooded, in some way flooded.
Yeah, in the early 20th century, Egyptologist George Reisner attempted to explore the pyramids of Nuri. He found them to be flooded, and though some artifacts were recovered, the work was not very extensive.
Yeah.
It was really hard to explore that kind of stuff during that time.
Yeah, they didn't have any like scuba gear or anything. They weren't doing underwater archaeology back then, basically. Now, there's a sentence in this article that goes, Reisner never published the results of his findings in Nuri, and for almost a century, the place was forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Forgotten by who?
I know. I just hate those kind of sentences. Nobody forgot this place existed.
I mean, I kind of forgot about it.
It's a whole cultural heritage monument. I think it's UNESCO World Heritage Site. Like, this is a very significant, important place. But because of the difficulty of excavation, more excavation work was not done. But that is the only way it was in any way forgotten.
I completely forgot about it.
Well, you never knew about it, so I don't know if that counts as forgetting. Anyway, okay, off my soapbox. I hate those words. The only people that forget things are the ones that never knew about it to begin with. But going on.
Mm-hmm.
So it is true, however, that pretty much no other excavations happened on these tombs that are underground and flooded until 2018, when Pierce Paul Creisman started working here. He was an experienced underwater archaeologist, and he got grants from the National Geographic Society and, you know, narrowed in on which tomb to focus on. And that was the tomb associated with the Pyramid of Nastasen. I don't know what the emphasis is on that one.
Nastasen. I don't know.
I don't know either.
Yep. Well, good thing the National Geographic Society was down with PPC, because he went in and...
Oh my God.
What?
Wow. You are so lame.
I just wanted to say that.
I know.
I have nothing leading past that.
No, you don't. You full stop on that sentence. Perfect.
Anyway, Nastasen, I'm going to go with Nastasen.
Okay.
Was the last king buried in this area. So his was closest to the Nile and most prone to flooding.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nastasen was one of the minor royals who ruled Kush from 335 to 315 BCE. I mean, that's 20 years.
20 years, right?
I mean, if I knew through a 20-year rule of, you know, this area that I was going to be known as a minor royal.
You know, I hesitated over that word, too. That word is in this article, and I didn't find corroboration in other sources for minor. I'm not really sure.
20 years.
Yeah.
That's a lot of time.
I got the impression
he didn't do much.
I know. I think it's because he came from one of the minor. He was elevated from a minor like royal family, like not necessarily from the like top bloodline.
Ruled.
He did.
I'm just like, it's so funny because there are names in like U.S. presidents. Like if you told me the name of a U.S. president from like, you know, the mid 1800s, mm-hmm. I'd be like, oh, yeah, I kind of remember that guy was a president. Mm-hmm. Like some of those people that just served like one term and didn't really do anything.
Yeah.
Really, we call them a minor president. You know what I mean? But we just don't use that.
Yeah.
You know, but they just like didn't do much. They were kind of in the middle.
Okay.
They just didn't.
All right. Settle down.
I'm just like very upset by the word minor.
Settle down. I don't think that's how that word is meant in this case. It just meant he came from one of the minor noble houses that wasn't the main bloodline.
I'm just saying. It's very insulting.
Okay. All right. Well, pretend I didn't use that word, because now I really regret not taking it out.
I don't like it. All right.
Okay. So very little is known about him. And of course, these researchers are hopeful that they can find out more things, fill in this picture of this last of the Nuri kings mm-hmm. by exploring his tomb.
Maybe the bandits will go visit him. The time bandits.
Oh, God. Well, one could hope, because that show is great. Reisner's crew in the early 1900s, they found the staircase that leads down into the tomb, right?
Yeah.
And they dug it out, because there wasn't too much water yet. Yep. And they were able to get into the first room of the tomb. And they definitely removed a bunch of what are called shabti.
Mm-hmm.
And those are little statues that are meant to look after the deceased in the afterlife. And then they left from there and just never returned.
Sure.
I don't know if it's because there was water in the way and they just really couldn't go any further, or if they just had bigger fish to fry. Other tombs were easier to excavate. Who knows? But they didn't return after that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also kind of like, okay, so cool. They went down the staircase. They opened the tomb for the first time because it seems like it was untouched before that. They entered. They took a bunch of artifacts and then they left. So what did they do exactly?
Yeah.
Yeah, they looted it. Well, that's looting.
Did they document it and put it at the British Museum?
Maybe. I don't know where those artifacts are now, actually.
If they did, it's not looting. Until somebody asked for it.
He didn't even publish his research on these pyramids, so I don't even know.
Was like, anything in the British Museum published?
Well, the early, yes, a lot of it is. And George Reisner is famous. He did the Giza pyramids, so like...
Oh, he's, see, it's not looting.
No, if you don't publish it, if you take the artifacts, I'm sure he gave the artifacts to the government. Mm-hmm. I'm going to hope he did. I don't know. So it's not actual looting, but boy, does it not like feel a little bit like that.
Mm.
Anyway...
I think honestly, the definition of looting is going to end up being what happens to the artifacts. If you keep them for yourself and put them on your mantle and don't tell anybody, that's looting. If you sell them to somebody else and profit off them, that's looting.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are the two big definitions.
But what if you're one of these old school archaeology guys and you care more about making a name for yourself really than anything else? And so you take these artifacts and you donate them to somewhere really important, and your name gets attached to that donation, and all of a sudden you're in the history books forever. So your form of compensation has come in notoriety and historical, like, history remembering you for doing this. So
all you did was donate and you didn't write anything?
Well, in this case, he didn't. I don't know. I just, yeah. I feel like what some of these archaeologists were doing in the early 1900s was just a half step over looting, and they were really doing it to gain fame and fortune in other ways.
I think you're using the word incorrectly, because I think some of these people that were calling archaeologists these gentlemen adventurers.
They weren't really doing archaeology.
They weren't archaeologists. Yeah. The field of archaeology in the late 1800s, early 1900s was again, little more than just gentlemen adventuring. These people who had money or had sponsors that were like, you know, hey, I'm going to go down and do this and you're going to pay me to do that. And I'm going to bring back these fantastic things and show the Victorian era, or show these, you know, show these fancy people these things.
Yeah.
That wasn't archaeology.
No, it wasn't.
But it was being called archaeology.
But at the same time, there were some people in that time period doing good archaeology.
Yeah.
It exists. It was there. They could have done it.
They were.
But... Yeah. And I don't really know a lot about George Reisner, so I don't want to like slander him right now. But, you know, it doesn't seem like in this particular instance he was trying to do good archaeology. He was just trying to get in there, find some stuff, and take it to wherever he was taking it to.
Right.
So anyway, moving on from that. Again, another soapbox.
Since then, the curse took over and the staircase was reburied and the entire tomb is now flooded. So,
is the curse global warming?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, actually.
Okay, cool.
The curse of technology and global warming.
Yeah.
Anyway, the first year of work in 2019 was just excavating the stairs because that was a job.
Yep.
Once they reached the tomb, the rest was underwater and they used tubes to breathe because stuba tanks. Once they'd reached the tomb entry, the rest is underwater, and they used tubes to breathe because scuba tanks were too bulky. They just couldn't make it through the area.
Yeah, that's what we were talking about in the beginning, how like that's how you can tell that the photos are kind of BS, because, they did not use tanks. They couldn't.
Which is shocking. The early Egyptians probably used tanks. I don't know how they didn't. They knew it was going to be underwater.
Okay. Do we need to talk about global warming and how that works?
Anyway.
There was no water back then. Yeah.
Well, no. I mean, the Egyptians, that's just why they had pyramids in those areas near the Nile. It was known for flooding.
Well, but they didn't necessarily want their tombs to flood. And I don't think at that time they were filling up with water.
Actually, a little bit shocking, to be honest with you. The Nile is known for also its movement in that area because it did move. It's called anastomosis when the rivers move like that. But anyway, the river moved a lot. So presumably when they built a pyramid there, although they did take, you know, 10, 20, 30 years to build pyramids sometimes, depending on how big it was. I don't know how long this one took to build, but and this tomb in particular. But it's kind of funny. Did they know that tomb was going to flood? Did the tomb start flooding before they even finished it?
I doubt it. It probably was in an area that was perfect in that short time frame, which geologically speaking, 20 years is only a tiny little blip, right? And it was probably perfect.
Doesn't take long for that river to move, though.
It was probably perfect in that time frame, and then now it's not.
Yeah, indeed.
So after they got into the tomb, and now it's all underwater, they began excavating in what they are calling Reisner's Pit, which is basically where the crew with Reisner first excavated in the 1900s. Sure. And they just basically started collecting all the dirt and sediment from this area and then pulling it out to do screening on it. Because they figured this tomb hasn't been touched. It can't have been touched because of all the water, unless you have gear, and nobody had gear until the last like 40 or 50 years. It wouldn't have even been possible. So
if you're following along, archaeology over 100 years ago was finding cool shit and raiding tombs, and now it's collecting dirt and literally taking it back to the lab and sifting through it.
Okay, well, it should have been collecting dirt back then too. They just weren't doing that. So
it's actually true though. Archaeology now is, hey, look at that cool bag of dirt. Let's take it back to the lab.
Yeah. Okay, but this bag of dirt is really cool because you know what they found in it? All kinds of little very thin pieces of gold foil that were likely used as decoration on figurines or boxes or plates, maybe, like whatever was in the tomb as offerings and gifts to go with the deceased. So they have all the gold still. All the other things that it was attached to would have been dissolved away because of the water. So
right.
It's kind of a catch 22, right? Like if it had been looted, maybe we would have some of those artifacts. And we do have the ones from 100 years ago only because they were taken out, because otherwise they would have dissolved in the water ever since then. But, you know, looting's not good either. So I don't know. Anyway, but what they're planning to do is continue to work through that sediment and find out what they can. And then in the third chamber, which is the deepest chamber or the furthest chamber, Nasus's sarcophagus still sits, like they think, undisturbed in the water, right? There's no reason to think that it had ever been looted or opened or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, from there, they haven't tried to open it yet. They haven't done anything to it yet. But I think the next steps are to, you know, figure out how to get it out of the underwater tomb so that they can open it and see what's left.
That will definitely open the curse. 100%.
Is that the mummy's curse?
100%.
Okay. Well, that's
that will either do something to Brendan Fraser, or I'm not really sure what's going to happen, but it'll be bad.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah, no, we don't believe in curses here. We just believe in knowledge. So
the curse of knowledge.
Yeah. Yes.
Anyway.
Yeah. Well, I just thought that article was really cool because it's a little bit more of an adventure moment in archaeology rather than just plain old, you know, scraping dirt away. Although it is scraping dirt away, but it's underwater, so that makes it cooler, right?
It does. Yeah. I actually really like reading about those early adventures. I'll have to see if I can remember eventually. I probably won't get in time for these show notes, but if I can ever remember, I'll try to post something about some of the other books I've read. Because I've probably given away. We gave away a lot of books to our local bookstore in Reno when we moved into an RV. Had a whole library of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I had some really cool books about some early adventures of people that were doing actually some what they would have called good science back in the day, you know, in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Mm-hmm. But there's those adventures where, you know, you get out and you hire the locals.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's really unethical these days, but you would have hired a whole bunch of locals and natives to help carry all of your stuff, your big Victorian furniture out into wherever, and then set up a tent while they go do all the digging and artifact finding, bring it back to you for cataloging.
Yeah.
While you sit and have a fancy meal and, you know, they do all the work. But either way.
Well, they don't get their hands dirty.
No.
They oversee. They're the guy with the clipboard. It's not any different today. They're just the guy, like, back in the day, they sat on their fancy blanket and drank wine. And today they're the guy with the clipboard. Yeah. So
one of the ones, if you're interested in paleoanthropology, that is just sticks in my mind all the time is, I can't remember the name of the book, but it was about Eugene Dubois, who discovered Java Man. And he was real famous for paying the locals to bring him fossil finds.
Oh, okay.
And because there was a very specific site they were excavating, mm-hmm. and he found that they just worked faster if he'd pay them mm-hmm. for the stuff that they found. Well, they found that if they broke them into pieces, they got paid more. So he had to stop that practice real fast.
Yeah.
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 So I think he ended up starting paying by weight.
Yeah.
Instead.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then they stopped breaking them. Mm-hmm. So, but you learn real quick.
Oh my gosh. So crazy.
Anyway. All right. So that was fun. We've got a lot of new stories to catch up on. There's actually quite a bit. Fall is a good time for this because, you know, people work a lot over the summer. They start reporting and mm-hmm. these things start coming out. So
yeah.
There's a lot of good stuff out there.
And I'm like super excited for the next episode because some of my favorite news stories are the ones where they like claim to have solved some like centuries old mm-hmm. mystery. So that's, we're going to look at some stories that are supposedly doing that next week.
All right. Well, with that, we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Culturo Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Say Bronze Age a couple times because you kept saying Bronze Age.
I do that every time I say it.
I know, just, and I can try to sub it in if there's some that are really bad.
Bronze Age. Bronze Age. Bronze Age. Bronze Age.
Bronze Age. Bronze Age.
Will you let me say it? You're just waiting to say it.
Sorry, go ahead.
Bronze Age.
I'm cutting all this together and giving it to Tilly.
Bronze. Okay. Bronze. Bronze Age. Bronze Age. Bronze Age. Bronze Age.
Stop it.
Bronze Age.
I can't wait to cut this together and give it
Bronze
to Tilly.
Bronze Age. Bronze. Bronze Age. Bronze Age.
I think we got it.
Bronze Age. Thanks, Tilly.